Welcome to Story of a Storyteller. I'm your host, Connor Braden. This is the show where I found out all about the ins and outs of the lives of storytellers of all kinds. You can find my free novella, The Stolen Dagger, episode show notes, links to all sorts of amazing books, and more at connorbraden.com/podcast. Enjoy! Hello, my friends and storytellers, and welcome to 2021. We did it. We broke free. Well, I hope we did, because I'm recording this on the 30th of December. But more importantly, welcome to season 2 of Story of a Storyteller, the podcast where I chat to amazing authors about their life stories, why they all became writers, and what they hope for in the future. I'm so happy to be finally back at the wheel with season 2, and thank you so much to everyone who supported, listened, and watched season 1. It was great, and I was really happy to see it reach 500 listens so quickly. That's a huge achievement, and I'm really, really proud of it. I have an amazing interview coming up for you today. I'll be talking to David Ledane. David is the author of Gay Dads, Forbidden Fruit, and Having Gay Sex. David and I talk about David's coming out story, how it affected his marriage and his role as a father, and how finding other men like him led to his new career as a writer. David is one of 6 dads in the Rainbow Dads podcast, as well as a member of the Queer Britain Museum. In my own writing news, I did finally finish the first draft of my children's fantasy book, but discovered along the editing way that it's really a 3-in-1 deal. I kind of realised after I'd finished it, I got to the end, it was really, really long, but I felt like there was so much more story to tell, so I've decided I'm splitting the original plot of one book into 3, and it's going to be a trilogy instead. It's a weird limbo, but I'll figure it out along the way. I'm also going to keep working away while I re-record the audiobook version of my novel, The Longest Night. Plenty to keep me going, I can tell you. And if you're interested in hearing The Longest Night as it's recorded, you can join my Patreon page. For those who don't know, Patreon is a subscription service where fans and listeners of this show can sign up for as little as €1 a month and unlock different perks, such as a shout out and a thank you here on the podcast, an advertising space on my website, connorbraden.com, and so much more other stuff. But the newest thing is to get the chapters of the audiobook chapter by chapter as they're finished, which I think will be really exciting. Anyway, enough about me. Let's listen to David Ledane.
Hello, and welcome to Story of a Storyteller, the podcast where I get to talk to storytellers about their life story. And my guest today is David. Oh, man. Sorry, David. I do this every episode in season 1. I forget to ask, how do you pronounce your surname? So is it Ledane?
Yes.
Hey.
It wasn't that hard.
No, but it's just one of those, like, you know when it's a surname you haven't seen before? It's always like, oh, wait, how do I say this right? So David Ledane, sorry about that. I have a surname that everyone always mispronounces, so I should be conditioned to ask people before I hit record. But hey, we're here. Who cares? David is the author of 3 different books that are released and a 4th one on its way. He has Gay Dad, 10 True Stories of Divorced Gay Men Living in the UK Today, which came out in 2016. This Forbidden Fruit, a culture and history guide to the homosexuality in men, that came out last year in 2019. And then Having Gay Sex, a guide to male homosexual sex in 2020. And he's also on the Rainbow Dads podcast. And he also works with the Queer British Museum on their social media team. So, David, you have a lot on your plate.
Well, you know, you have to keep busy, don't you? And lockdown has provided that time to do things, because I'm sure without lockdown, I wouldn't have been able to publish my latest book, Having Gay Sex. And I'm also working quite heavily on the next one. Which I'm sure we'll talk about later on. But so lockdown has provided time to do that sort of thing. But unfortunately, like a lot of people, having been furloughed for 6 or 7 months, I have now been made redundant. So, you know, tough times, but tough times for everyone. So hopefully, you know, I'm a half glass full type of guy. So hopefully something will come along. But yeah, so, you know, lockdown is just a strange, strange time for all of us. So I try to keep positive and try to keep busy. And yes, I seem to have my fingers in quite a lot of pies, but I like that. That's, you know, interesting. And you meet people and you, you know, you learn different things. And yeah, so I'm sure we'll talk about all these different things throughout the interview.
I think there's this whole wave of, I don't want to say lockdown inspired, but like creative things that came through lockdown. I mean, this podcast kind of the seeds were there before the lockdown, but I really got stuck into it during the first lockdown. I was on two podcasts myself, three actually, that all started during lockdown as well. So it seems like as many downsides as there has been to COVID and lockdown, there's also been one or two creative and positive sides as well. So
yeah, and I think when it's all over, there'll be a huge sort of burgeoning creative career, you know, stuff coming out from all over, you know, from theatre and film and, you know, people doing their thing in their living room, you know, making their art in whatever form that might be. So, yeah, I think it'll be an incredible time to look back on in so many ways.
Yeah, definitely will. And speaking of looking back, could we look back at your beginnings and like, you know, very young David? So maybe you could tell us a little bit about where you were born and your family and growing up and all that.
Yeah, sure. So I was born on the Isle of Wight, which has featured in the news recently with a tanker being hijacked. So yeah, so I was born on the Isle of Wight. I was adopted as a baby. So I've always had that sort of outsider otherliness and not being like other kids around me at school, I guess. But also having, you know, as I grew up, the sexual awareness. So that also played into this sort of, you know, being different. And also, I think I definitely have a fear of abandonment as well, which
makes sense. I'm sure, your background, like,
Yeah, which I'm sure is to do with being adopted. So coming out was very difficult for me. And I think, you know, looking back, all those sort of hidden emotions and things that are buried deep play a part that we don't really consciously know about. So I was adopted and lived on the south coast of England ever since, really. I live in Chichester, West Sussex. And yeah, sort of had a normal upbringing. My parents were very of the war generation, so they were very there was no sort of aspiration to, you know, better themselves. It was always a case of you know, what's the phrase, make and men do. Yeah, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I can't remember the exact phrase, but I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, and they came from an Edwardian. Their parents were, you know, from an Edwardian age, so they were very distant and not emotional and not, you know, I mean, they loved us, but not in a demonstrative way, really. So I grew up you know, went to school like everybody else. But yeah, I can remember even as an infant at infant school, I enjoyed sort of dressing up and playing at being, you know, creative and being a bit sort of flamboyant, though, you know, I wouldn't consider myself to be that way. But yeah, so I was always interested in the arts rather than, you know, science,
rather than everything else.
Yeah.
And you just mentioned, you just said us, so I'm assuming you have siblings. How many siblings do you have, and were they adopted as well? Or like, how was the family structure? How did the family come to be, I suppose?
Yeah, so I had an older brother who was also adopted. And he's unfortunately no longer with us. He died in 2008 from AIDS.
Oh, okay.
So obviously that was, you know, a very difficult time for me because I was sort of out, but not quite. So, you know, that whole period sort of shoved me back into the closet, really, because I was really frightened that that would be the way that I would end up. That was what would happen to me. And, you know, growing up through the 80s with the AIDS pandemic, I guess, really, you'd call it. It was a very difficult time. And I remember sitting in the pub with my friends, you know, talking about AIDS, and they were glibly saying, oh, you know, we could all get it, we could all have it, you know. And I was, and this was, you know, 1983, 4, 5, whatever. And I was thinking, no, I could have it more than you could, you know, I'm the one. So it was a really scary time. And then, you know, later on, my brother got ill. He was in complete denial. He didn't have any treatment. Not that there was a lot available then, but he could have had treatment, but he refused it. And he just died an awful death, really, you know, on his own. And yeah, terrible.
That must have, must have been very difficult for you, kind of, to, well, first of all, to lose your brother to such a terrible illness, but also to, like, there must have been a lot of kind of, I suppose, guilt, maybe, because, you know, you kind of approaching coming out and then this happens to your brother. And, like, you know, that must have been a really confusing and difficult time.
Really, really difficult. Yeah, all these different emotions going on. I was sort of angry, you know, I was angry at him for not to, doing something about it and getting treatment and just forgetting it, you know, just, you know, because I had no idea that he was gay or bisexual or whatever he was, because he was very, you know, he was quite an isolationist person, you know, he kept himself to himself. So, yeah, so I was angry, I was scared, I was confused, I was, you know, I'm not like that, that's not going to happen to me. And at the time I had a young family, so it was, yeah, really, really difficult. But, you know, time heals, time changes things, you move on and things get better and, you know, yeah, so
yeah,
it is what it is.
Yeah, it is, but also it's something that, you know, I think a lot of people outside the LGBT kind of group sphere, I suppose, don't realize that AIDS wasn't just the 80s, that you know, that it's people are still getting diagnosed with it, and you know, it's not as life-threatening as it once was because of all the treatments that have developed over the years, but it's still a really serious issue that still crops up. And I mean, you say your brother died in 2008. That's not that long ago, really.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But interestingly, because obviously there was a big surge of AIDS in the 80s.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the next generation sort of forgot that. And they thought, oh, well, that was, you know, that was that lot back in San Francisco and California or whatever. You know, people who are on the scene and whatever. So that's not going to affect us. And of course, then there was another surge in the early 2000s, you know, when the next generation comes along. But this is why it's so important that we tell our stories, because with each generation, each LGBT generation that disappears, so their stories and experiences and culture and history disappears with them. And it's only very recently that we've been able to talk like this, you know, and be open about things. So, you know, podcasts and the things that you do are really important, you know, to give people a chance to tell their story.
I'd like to bring us back a little bit to when you said you went to school like everybody else. No, it's fine. Some people don't. I mean, I was on a podcast where the host was homeschooled her entire life. So, you know, some people don't go to school. what, so you said that you you used to kind of do the more the arts and the more expressive and the dress up box when you were very, very young. Like, throughout your school life, was your creativity encouraged, or was it something that, because you kind of knew you may have been a little bit different to the other boys in school, was it something you kind of suppressed a little bit? Or
I think so. There was no enthusiasm to get anybody to do anything really back in those days. It was just get you through the system and get you some sort of certificate at the end. You were really just a number. And it was very easy to not participate. You know, I always could write a better story than anybody else, but I was not encouraged and I couldn't be bothered. You know, and it was easier just to be, you know, part of the cool gang. And I was always quite cool because I was a huge David Bowie fan and I had the Ziggy hair, you know, Ziggy Stardust hairstyle and everything. And I was a natural redhead. So, okay. Being tall as well, I always stood out in the crowd. So I sort of used that, I think, to my own advantage. So I was part of the cool crowd. As much as I enjoyed writing, and I always have written and kept diaries and things, which are now really fantastic to look back on, really revealing, which again, lockdown has given me the time to do, to look back on old diaries. But, you know, what a troubled person I was, looking back. And if I'd only had somewhere that I could go, some people that could point me in the right direction, someone to look up to. But of course, there was none of that then. There was none of that. The only gay people we knew were sort of Larry Grayson and Dick Emery and, you know, people like that. And these sort of vaudeville caricatures of what gay was, but I wasn't like that.
They're very particular. I think the word character you said, like, I think that's exact, because the nearest equivalent today would be like Alan Carr and Graham Norton. They're kind of the evolution of those figures. It's just like that's a really particular type of LGBT person that it's the most palatable to the mainstream. So, when that's the only one shown, that's what a lot of people would think, oh, that's what that is, and I'm not that, so I mustn't be gay either.
Yeah. But I think, you know, the likes of Alan Carr and Graham Norton and such, they are comfortable and they're sort of sexless, if you like. Maybe not Graham Norton so much. But, some of the others, I can't, you know, bring to mind. But and that's why they appeal to the general public. Mums and grannies like them because they're safe. There was no one when I was growing up, apart from David Bowie. He was the only one who gave me that it was okay to be different. That you didn't have to really explain your sexuality, because, you know, when he came on telly and he was singing Starman and pointing down the camera lens at me, that just meant so much, you know. So to have that, and it sort of made it okay to be a bit different and a bit flamboyant and have your hair different and dress a bit different, and, you know, to have posters of a male pop star on your bedroom wall, because it was David Bowie, it sort of made it okay, because he was so cool and his music and everything about him was so cool, that it was okay. But had it not been for him, there was no one else around really that
Bowie, especially in the early 80s and the See, Stardust kind of era, was very androgynous as well. Like, you could forgive some people for, like, when Bowie was first kind of coming to the fore, for seeing an image of Bowie with all the makeup and thinking that it was just a very masculine looking woman. Do you know? So it's kind of that, probably gateway is the wrong word, but that's probably like the reason why he was so accessible and it was easy to like him as a young gay person at a time, and it wouldn't be okay to have a male pop star on your bedroom wall, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Because all the sort of other male rock stars really were all dressed in denim, and it was all, you know, it was all heavy rock. You know, there was nothing, there was the sort of glam thing, which was the other end of the scale. You know, bands like Sweet, and they tried to be cool, and they tried to copy, but you know, they just didn't get it right. And he was always at the forefront of you know, experimenting and doing stuff. And he made that possible for ordinary kids to do. You know, if you wanted to dress a bit strangely or wear makeup or whatever, that was okay to do that. So you know, he was great to have around, but and his music as well was really everything.
You're clearly a huge boy fan, so I'm going to ask you a very mean question, and you're not going to like it at all. If you can only listen to one boy song ever again, and you can only pick one, what one would it be?
Young Americans.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Any particular reason?
It's just always, that album has always been, because that I was, 15 at the time. So it was really important for me at that time, you know, growing up as a teenager and just, yeah. So, and Young Americans has always been my favorite. In fact, I even recorded a version of it. I went for my 50th birthday. Friends of mine bought me some time in a studio and recorded it with backing vocals and everything. It was really, really good. And it's never going to get aired. So.
I don't know. I could find an MP3 that could be at the end of this interview. That could be a little track.
maybe. But yeah. So that's why I always go back to Young Americans. But you know, I would miss a lot of his catalogue, obviously.
Yeah, obviously, and it's such a big catalogue as well. So
yeah.
You say you said that you used to write diaries a lot when you were younger and like through your adult life. So was writing ever a career path in your head, or was it just something you did because you enjoyed it?
It was something that I did. Keeping diaries, I don't think was a case of I did it because I enjoyed it. It was almost a sort of, I had to do it, a need. And I think what I was doing was it was sort of self-help. It was, you know, putting down into words what I was feeling and what the people around me were doing and thinking and, you know, what was happening and, you know, different sort of crushes I had on people, boys and girls, and, you know, trying to understand that. So it wasn't a case certainly with the diaries, it wasn't a case of, you know, it was being creative. It was just something that I had to do. But I also did, certainly in my teens, dabble in writing. I always wanted to write a film script or a play, you know, or a novel, but never quite got around to, you know, the first three chapters. It was always a good idea, but, you know, the amount of time that you have to spend, you know, other writers who are listening into this will appreciate the amount of time that goes into writing a book is phenomenal. And people forget that when they have this bright idea of, oh, you know, I could write a book. So there was always that creative outlet. I've always written in some form or another.
Okay, cool. And seeing as we're starting to talk about writing, we're going to jump ahead so that we can continue looking back, which will make sense to you in a second. Your first book is called Gay Dad, and it's about 10 different men who were married and had children and then came out as gay or, you know, bisexual or whatever. And that is basically your own story as well. So I'd like to kind of talk about that a bit. I know that you're still close with your ex-wife, I believe.
Yeah, very.
So like what was, my main question is, what was that like? Because that must have been so difficult. And so, like, so can you tell me a bit maybe about your ex-wife?
Well, it's my story, so I'll tell it from my my point of view. Yeah. So I always thought that I was bisexual because I had girlfriends and I was, I wouldn't say I was attracted to their sexuality, but I was attracted to their personality and their gender. And I always had girlfriends, you know, I was surrounded by friends and still do have. But so, you know, we fell in love, we met and we fell in love. And, you know, that's it. That's the story, really. And one thing led to another, you know, we lived together and, you know, we had a good sex life and there was no problem with that. I wasn't playing around or doing anything other than, you know, being in a relationship with her. That changed later on, but certainly to begin with, it was just the two of us, and we were, you know, we were going to go to London and have a new life and together, and so it was great, and we did that. We went up to London, we bought a flat, and we got jobs, and you know, everything was good. And this was late 80s, early 90s, and then one thing led to another, and then over the washing up one evening, we decided that we might be a good idea to get married, so we did.
How romantic.
But it was always just I could not envisage my life without this person in it, and that was always the case. So the thought of getting married was not alien to me. It wasn't scary. I wasn't thinking, oh, should I be doing this? Mm. Because I knew, I knew that I had, I was attracted to men and I would fantasize about men and, you know, any pornography that I was watching or looking at was about men. But I was in love with this woman. So yeah. it was just normal. And there was no you know, battle going on inside my head.
Seems like you segmented your romantic life with your physical attractions almost.
Yeah, and I think you are absolutely right, Connor. What was happening was I was compartmentalizing my life, and certainly, you know, as after we got married. And we were living in London, I did start to, you know, play around and do things outside the marriage very irregularly and not often. And I thought, well, that's okay because, you know, it's not going to affect my marriage. She's never going to find out, you know, it's all, you know, somewhere else. I've not got a boyfriend as such. I was just, you know, having extramarital sex and that's all it was. So I didn't see it as an emotional attachment. It was just scratching an itch, if you like. And so, you know, we were married for a number of years. And then after a few years, we had our first child. And then a couple of years later, the second one was on his way. And this was at the time. And so just going back. So after our first child was born, I was the one who stayed at home as the stay-at-home dad. And my wife went back to work full time. The reason
being, would have been very unusual at that time as well.
Yeah, again, you know, my life is full of sort of unusual things. I get put into sort of unusual situations, you know, it seems. But that's just, you know, life. I'm sure everyone's life is just as crazy.
Yeah.
So she went back to work. I was commuting at the time. We were living in Chichester in West Sussex, and I was commuting to Epsom in Surrey and earning less than her. So it just didn't make sense for me to carry on. And she wanted a career, you know, she wanted to do that. So I stayed at home and brought up the kids. And when my first son was starting to go to nursery, home computers were starting to come in and the internet was starting to open up. And so I started to write. I started to fill my time with writing, because there's only so much dusting and hoovering you can do, you know. You have to stay sane. So I took all these ideas that I'd had throughout my past, you know, years, and decided that I would write a novel. And so that's what I did. And then our second son was coming along, and my wife found some material that I'd downloaded, and a forum that I was chatting in. And for some reason, I'd kept the I kept a copy of what I'd been talking about in this forum for some unknown reason. But I think what I was doing was leaving evidence and leaving a trap, really. I think I wanted to come out, and I wanted to be free, if you like, but I couldn't find a way of doing that, and I couldn't find a way of not hurting her. So I was sort of leaving evidence, and anyway, she found it, and we, you know, it was awful, and we had this big discussion and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I reverted to this ridiculous situation of, but you must understand that that's not affecting our marriage. That's something outside the marriage. And, you know, it doesn't affect us. And, you know, we're still in love, and we've got kids and another one on the way, and blah, blah, blah. And so we carried on for 5 years living in the same house, but basically separated. Okay. And we were living more and more separate lives. And eventually she decided to move out and set up home on her own. And I stayed in the family home with the kids. So, and then we got divorced, and, you know, split the house, and
all those things.
So it goes on. But coming back to the gay dad book. So when we were divorcing, I was, you know, in a group online with some other gay dads, and it's just a supportive group, you know, and it was so cathartic and so helpful to just to be able to, you know, listen to other people's stories and to realize that you're not the only one that this has ever happened to. Because at the beginning I thought, this, what am I doing? I'm the only person, obviously, that would do such a stupid thing, thinking that, you know, that you can control sexuality like that, where you can't, obviously. And so, but I was also looking for a book that I could read that gave me the stories of other men in the same situation. And there was just nothing out there, nothing available. So I thought, aha, I know what I'll do. I'll write that book myself.
Yeah.
So I approached the guys and said, you know, would anyone like to, you know, talk to me about their stories? And of course I was inundated with people who wanted to do that, because people want to tell their stories. And if you give them the opportunity to do so, they will.
I'd say it was hard just to pick 10, like, because that's what the title of the book is. Now, I know you listened to a lot of them, but...
I mean, a lot of them were very similar. So what I tried to do was to pick out ones that were dissimilar to each other. And, you know, it was guys from different backgrounds. One guy who's bisexual and a Sikh, which was a really interesting different take on it. And, you know, his marriage was arranged. So, you know, a very different take on the whole thing. But yeah, so it's 10 completely different stories, but of course the theme is the same, and how they work through this and how they come out the other end is different in most occasions. Most of them have a happy ending, and both the wives and you know, the men and the children as well are in the right place eventually.
But, yeah,
you know, it can be a very bumpy ride and very traumatic for everyone involved, and it can go on for years. Because it's all very well, you know, as you know, coming out, But then, you know, that's not the end of it. You know, you have to get on with life, and you have to live with people, and you have to try and work around how this is going to work. And then if you go through divorce, of course, that can be very acrimonious. And you know, some wives are really bitter and feel that, you know, their whole lives have been it's been a forgery. It's been a fake.
Which is understandable too. Like, I understand that the men that they were with, and like the and you and your wife, I understand that, you know, society has put these, or religion, or there's all sorts of external factors that force the men into this situation, and then unfortunately it ends up two people suffering, you know, that a marriage breaks down no matter what way you look at it. And I know sometimes sometimes it's healthier for couples to separate, but even when they have children. So it's an unfortunate consequence, I suppose, of having a society that didn't allow people to be who they are.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, people get divorced for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah.
People don't stay together if they're not happy, and it, you know, sexuality is just one of the, you know, many things that people get divorced for. But there is a stigma attached, you know, to it, that, you know, on both sides, for women as well, who, I mean, I don't want to speak for the women, and certainly wouldn't want to speak for my wife, but I would imagine that there's some stigma that, how could you marry a man?
Yeah.
And you must have known he was gay. And certainly, you know, my wife knew that I'd had sexual relationships with men, and so that wasn't hidden at all, but you know, she thought that she could change me through love, and I thought that I could deal with it. I thought that I could compartmentalize it, but
which you can't, you know.
Which you can't, and you shouldn't have to, and you shouldn't be in a society that makes you do that. You should be able to live your life and be who you are. But when society shows you no other than the heteronormative status quo, what do you do? You just fall in line and go with what's happening around you and what feels easy and what feels comfortable. Why would you fight against it?
The path of least resistance.
Yeah.
I mean, it's... For anyone listening or watching that are outside of Ireland and the UK, there was a, maybe 2 or 3 years ago now, maybe it was only last year, I don't know, 2020 just messes up your sense of time, doesn't it? But when Philip Schofield came out, I mean, he had a wife, he had kids, and then he came out, he was a TV presenter, and he came out, and it was baffling. Like, I remember in the staff room at lunchtime, the day that it happened, like, a lot of people on the staff were like, I can't believe it. And the big thing everyone kept saying was, oh, his poor wife. And I was kind of like, well, hang on. There's two victims here, you know, and they're neat. Like, in a situation like yours, there's no one's a winner. Like, it's a kind of a case where, unfortunately, two people suffer from the effects of a society where heteronormativity is forced on everybody. So
and you know, really difficult for him to come out like that in the public eye
and live on TV. Like, that was
live on TV. Yeah. You know, but also what was I going to say? I've lost my thread now. That's okay. Difficult for him to come out in the public eye, but difficult for his wife as well, you know, that whole, that's what I was going to say. The strange thing is, what you just said there struck a chord, because a lot of gay people just assumed that he was gay. I wasn't surprised at all. I don't know.
I was surprised that he was, how can I put it? It was kind of the thing of, he had been in the public eye for so long, and especially, this is going to sound very insensitive of me, but especially nowadays when it's not really that like when a celebrity comes out, it's generally not a huge deal. People don't really mind as much. So it was kind of in my head, I was only surprised because I was like, oh, well, he hadn't come out already. So I just assumed that he actually wasn't. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Which I know is wrong of me to think, like, I mean, obviously people can.
I mean, I don't think I had any thoughts about him or his sexuality before that, really. But I wasn't surprised. You know, I just thought, okay, fine. And also, you know, people talk about his poor wife and, you know, and all that. But I think she was, from what I gather, from what he said, you know, she was very supportive. But we don't know what goes on behind closed doors.
No, and I think that's the most important thing to take.
You know, and yeah, I think we should just leave them alone. You know, he did what he felt he needed to, and they should just be left alone and to live their lives in whichever way they want.
Exactly. And I think that's the same with all situations like this and like yours. It's a case of when it was yours and your wife's decision to separate when you did. And, you know, it's a kind of a thing of that's your business and your wife's business, and your ex-wife's business and nobody else's. And I mean, it seems like you're better for it. I mean, you're so much involved so actively in the LGBT sphere, and you still have a good relationship with her, which I think is a really good testament to your relationship before as well. Can I ask, because there's one thing that I think is very interesting about the book Gay Dad in particular, is that every person that's on the LGBT plus spectrum knows the experience of having to come out to their parents. And usually that is the way it goes, that the child comes out to their parents. But you obviously had to go the opposite way, which is highly unusual, of a parent having to explain to their children, you know. So what was that like? How old were your sons when you told them why you were separating, and how did they take it?
Well, we never did tell them, and I was surprised at that, actually, because I thought that my wife would have told them, but we never had that discussion. It was very odd. I think because I was the dad and I was a stay-at-home dad, so I was always around and I remained always around. Mm. And, you know, I think a mother-child relationship is strong anyway, naturally, I would guess, in most cases. And so she had a very strong relationship with them. And when we separated and when she moved out of the family home, there was never any argument about, you know, custody or you know, when she could see them or when I saw them or whatever. It was very fluid. And so they just got used to the fact of that they had, you know, two parents in separate homes. Again, you know, when I was a child at school, my parents got divorced. And that was really unusual then, you know. And again, that sort of, you know, pointed me out as being an outsider and having something unusual about him, because his parents got divorced. But these days, you know, like half of their class, you know, the single parents or parents divorced or whatever, or, you know, same-sex couples. So it wasn't something that they were shocked about or needed answers about, I guess. All they needed was to be loved and feel secure. And of course, that's what they had in bucketfuls. So, you know, so there wasn't that sort of, oh, we must tell them why. And they never asked. But I did wonder, you know, I did think as the years went by, well, surely it must have come up in conversation. Surely, you know, my wife must have mentioned it, but apparently not. And when Gay Dad came out, so did I, big time. David LaDain is a pen name because I didn't want my kids to have any detrimental effect from it. And you know, I could have been on This Morning sofa with that story. You know, I was offered it, and I worked with a PR company, and I could have had a double page spread in, you know, daily newspapers. But of course, they wanted a picture and they wanted me to appear. And I wasn't willing to do that because I wanted to protect my family. So so the pen name has stuck, you know, because it's just a brand name and it would be difficult now to change it. And it just works. So I wrote that book. And I also was on later on, a few months later, I think it was about the August time, August, September, I was on Radio 4's Woman's Hour talking about gay dads. Well, that was fine because nobody could see it. See me. They could only hear me. And the chances of anyone hearing me and recognising my voice was remote. So that was okay. But I just thought, you know what, if they found out from somebody else, that would just be horrific. So I decided that I would tell them, and it was just before the summer holidays, so that they would have the whole summer holidays to get used to the idea, you know, they could talk to their friends, and you know, so anyway, so I took them out. We went to a film. I think it was one of the James Bond films. Anyway, it was an action film. And then we went for a pizza afterwards, and the pizza place was packed. And I said, I can't do it now. It was like, when am I going to? And you know, this is all going on in my head. And oh my God. And I was driving them back to their mums, and I just thought, I've got to say something. I've got to do it. I've got to do it now. Otherwise I'm not going to do it. So as we pulled up outside the gate, I said, before you get out, there's something I've got to tell you. Oh God, sorry. It's something I've got to tell you. And I of course, once you've said that,
you can't there's go no back. Going
back because you've got to say something. And so it came out. So I told them, and they were absolutely fine. You know, they're modern kids. They see, you know, they have friends who are questioning their sexuality, and they see same sex couples, and it's not a big deal. It's not a problem. And, you know, there was hugs and kisses and all that sort of stuff. And it was all great. And they've been really supportive since. You know, they've been along with me to Rainbow Dad events and Queer Britain events. You know, so they're really supportive. But they don't ask any questions and we don't really talk about it. But you know, they know that they can if they want to.
I'd imagine that's more because you're their dad and they don't want to know that stuff. Because that's you know, that like that, for example, my partner, he has nieces and nephews, and like they're all the oldest of them is 6 or 7 or something like that, and they never ask. Like I've been part of their lives all their lives, and they know me just as much as they know him, to the point that he gets annoyed about it actually, because if he ever does go to see them without me, the first question is like, "Where's Connor?" But I suppose the same thing, like they don't ask those questions about who we are and all that, because that's just like, well, that's normal. That's part of it.
And I think also you don't sort of realize that your parents are
people.
I was going to say humans, but that's a bit dumb. You don't realize that your parents are people and individuals, I think, until you're an adult, because you just see them as a provider of, you know, love and support and security, and they play a role. I think it's only as you get older that parents become something else, and that you see them for their personality and their individuality, you know, and as people. And I think my two now, I mean, my eldest is living in Canada, and he'll be 23 in December, and my youngest is just started university, so he's 18. So they're adults, you know, and they're living their lives now, and I'm living my life, my true life.
It's I was saying this before, saying this to you, words aren't coming today. I was saying this to you before we started recording of how, you know, it's something I think LGBT people, but all society in general kind of forgets that, you know, gay rights and visibility for people that are LGBT plus and all those kind of things, and being out and marriage laws and adoption law, all these kind of things are very, very new. I mean, like, it was only in 2015 here that the equal marriage law was brought in. First country in the world to do it by popular vote, actually. So it's a kind of a thing of that I think we all tend to forget that, you know, that it's not that long ago, and people like you did have to go through a lot of more difficult things. I mean, I'm a primary teacher, and most years I have done, whenever we do anti-bullying week, I go to the four oldest classes in the school and I talk to them about the homophobic bullying that I went through, which isn't unique to me. I don't think there's a single person who's LGBT plus that hasn't been bullied because of it. And I always speak to them, and there's always this shock amongst these children that, what, you couldn't always get married? And then I remember one year I said to kids, because, for example, being gay, it was illegal in Ireland. Like, the actually just being gay was illegal in Ireland until 93. So I always start that talk with kids saying, when I was born, I broke the law. And there's always this shock of what? And that's the thing we all have to remember, that, you know, there are still LGBT people that are still getting through the collective trauma, I suppose, of a society that wasn't very welcoming and very open.
Yeah. You know? But I think it's still very difficult for many people to come out, because, you know, it very much depends on your peer group, your family setup, possibly your religion, where you live, what country you're born into, you know. It's potluck, really, if you're in a society and in an immediate family circle that are supportive of you. And it is even now still luck and still difficult for people to come out. But again, you know, the more that we talk about it and tell our stories, the better. Yeah. Yeah.
To talk now a little bit about your, we kind of talked a lot about your first book, Gay Dad, and then the other two books, Forbidden Fruit and Having Gay Sex. The three of them seem to me, and you kind of said this earlier, it seems like to me, from the outsider now, I haven't read all your books, but that you kind of wrote the books that you wish were on the shelf when you were that 15-year-old kid who was obsessed with David Bowie. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. But not also the kid then, but for me now. You know, when I was researching Gay Dad, I was finding out things that I never knew, you know, and I'm thinking, how do I not know these things? You know, I've been around a while. And I realized that, as we've said before, it's because each generation, their culture and their history and their stories are lost and not talked about. And this is one of the problems, actually, of equality and diversity. Is that because it's becoming more mainstream and more acceptable, we sort of disappear. Do you know what I mean? So, for instance, like bookshops, LGBT bookshops and publishing, there's virtually no publishers now who specialize in LGBT publishing, apart from very small niche companies, because... you know, the main publishing houses will say, well, we have a stable of LGBT authors. We don't need any more, you know, because they're thinking about the money and it is a niche market. And the same with bookshops. You know, back in the day, these places were havens to go to find your stories and knowledge. So I wrote this Forbidden Fruit, which is about culture and history, mainly UK culture and history, because I was just flabbergasted that I didn't know these stories, you know, even from, you know, Henry VIII and the 1533 Buggery Act and why that came about. And, it wasn't necessarily about homosexuality. It was about fighting against the church. You know, it was just another way of fighting against the church, the Catholic Church, because, you know, if priests thought that they could be, put to the stake or hung, drawn and quartered or whatever, that they would lose all their property and money. That was the thing. That's what he wanted to get hold of. Yeah. That was basically why that law came into being, because before then, issues around sexuality were dealt with in the local courts, you know, and you'd just be put in the pillories or whatever, you know. It wasn't such a big thing. So yeah, so that and right through history, you know, the pirates of the 17th century the last men to hang for sodomy in the UK. Just all sorts of stories that I found out, just unbelievable. And also interestingly, sorry, Connor.
No.
Also interestingly, that we often assume that gay sexuality was invented in the 20th century, you know, with the porn industry especially, and cruising and all those other things. But it wasn't at all. These things have always been going on, always, and they're well documented. And, you know, going back to the diaries thing again, there are, you know, men who lived hidden lives, secretive lives, who kept diaries, which are absolutely fascinating now, of course, to look back on and reveal their hidden worlds that they frequented and moved in, and often written in code as well, so that even if their diaries were seen by somebody, that the other person wouldn't immediately know what they were talking about. And interestingly enough, again, when I was writing my diaries, certainly as a young teenager, I would write things in code just in case, you know, which is really bizarre, because, you know, who do we write diaries for? We just,
yeah.
You know, is it for us to read at a later date?
There's the fear of somebody else finding it probably made you write the code, you know.
And yeah. Of course.
But were you able to remember and translate the code? When you looked back as an adult?
Yeah, it
wasn't very subtle.
Wasn't very clever. Yeah, you can get it through the context of what's going on, you know what I mean? So yeah,
kids think they're so smart. Yeah. Then they're not.
No.
There's one thing, just when you're talking about codes and stuff, that that I thought was very interesting. Just because Oscar Wilde would be a very prominent historical gay figure for both the UK and for Ireland. And one thing I thought was very interesting in his time, I wrote a short story for a competition maybe 2-3 years ago now. And I wanted it to be about a romantic story between two men, but they could never marry because of society and all that. And I wanted to flood the thing with as much symbology and the secret codes that would have been very prominent in the day. So like the lambda, which is a Greek letter, was used around Oscar Wilde's time. So one of the characters' names is Darren Lamb, but then when you flip it, it's Lam-da-ren. And then like even one thing, I think carnations, the flower, they're normally white, but
green.
What people used to do is dye them green. Put them in water with green dye, and then if you're wearing a green carnation, that was like a secret code of we're the same, we can connect in that way. So it's mad, like it's these secret codes were everywhere. And I mean, you even have a glossary of, is it Polari? Isn't that the name?
Polari,
of the,
which was a sort of a secret language that was. It's dying out now, I think. I mean, it was very sort of theatrical and around theatres and performance, and started in Soho, I think, as so that groups of gay men could talk about, you know, people walking into the pub or whatever, and talk openly about them without them knowing. So yeah, but interesting, yeah, really interesting.
Yeah. So could you tell us now, that's kind of, we'll call that whole the beginning part of you and kind of how it got, you got to here. So now I'd like to talk a little bit more of you as a writer. What, with three books written and you have a fourth on the way as well, I heard you say in a different interview somewhere that lockdown enabled you to become a full-time writer. So what has that been like, being a full-time writer?
Well, it's kept me sane, to be honest, because, you know, without it, I think I would have been climbing the walls. But I've always written, since I've been writing seriously, you know, in the last, 5 or 6 years, I always try and write something every day. Even if it's just going back over what I've written the day before, or, you know, doing a bit of editing or whatever, or research. And so I always try and do something every day. But obviously, with lockdown, I've had more time to do that. So it's been really, I've been able to get on. As I said to you earlier, had I not had that time, certainly having Gay Sex wouldn't have been out this year. And I certainly wouldn't have been as far along the line as I am with my next book. It's been good to have that time, which obviously, you know, when you're working and you've got a family, it's really difficult to find the time to write. And people say to me, you know, back in the day when we were working and everything was normal, people used to say, well, how do you find time to write with all this going on, you know, kids at home and family life and everything? But I think when you find your passion, whatever that is, it might be music or football or whatever, when you find it, you nothing's going to stop you from doing it. You just have to keep going and you have to keep at it. And you find by doing that, you end up writing something of substance and that could possibly be a book, you know. Okay. And then you approach people to get it edited or proofread or whatever, and structured, and there you are, you have a book in your hand. And then, you know, like with Gay Dad, that had such a big impact on my life, because you know, people were starting to approach me to do other things like the Rainbow Dads.
And that's what I wanted to get on to next. So perfect. You segued yourself into the next part. Tell us a bit about Rainbow Dads and what it is.
So I was approached by a guy called Nicholas McInerney, who picked up the Gay Dad's book because he is a gay dad. And he approached me and a number of other guys, some of whom I knew through my book, but others I didn't. And approached us to do a podcast. So to basically sit down in a studio in Goldsmiths in London for a couple of weekends in this sort of little room down in the basement somewhere and talk about our experience of being gay dads and coming out and, you know, our wives and kids and how all that worked out. But the extraordinary thing is that to get men to sit around, there was half a dozen of us, different ages, different backgrounds again. But to get men to sit and talk and be emotive and talk about their feelings is hard, I think. I think men tend not to do that unless you are locked in a room and you have someone, you know, like Nicholas, who was very good at, you know, asking the questions and pushing us in the direction, whatever. And there was some, I don't know how many, because I know you said you've listened to one or two. I don't know how many you've listened to. So there's six. There's and each one is focuses on a particular time in the coming out process. So, you know, growing up, questioning your sexuality, getting married, then coming out, and day zero, and then you know, how you tell your kids and then how things pan out afterwards. And there are some jaw-dropping moments in those podcasts when people reveal things that you just think that is unbelievable, you know. And there's tears and there's laughter, and I'm sure that these guys, and myself included, would not have been so open and so, you know, honest had we not had that sort of setup. I think that's what touches people, and the normality of it. And you know, we have people, I think there's been over 7,000 downloads now. And we have people in Russia and India and Mexico who, you know, get in touch and say how fantastic it's been for them. Because obviously, you know, if you live in Russia, I mean, there's no chance. So to be able to listen, just to listen to other men who have the same feelings that you have, is very powerful, very powerful.
Yeah. It's great, and it won some awards as well, I know. So it's, I think that's a testament.
Well, yeah, it was nominated for an award.
Oh, nominated. We didn't. To be honest, there's so many podcasts out there that to be nominated is an award in and of itself.
Oh, like, yeah.
It was
a proud moment.
Yeah. It's a really interesting podcast. And I've, as I said, I only got to listen to a bit of it. So it is something I am going to listen all the way through, because it's just such an interesting story. And like you said, like, even I've listened to maybe an episode and a half, nearly, I think. Oh, I don't know. I kind of binge listen to podcasts, so I don't know where one episode starts and one finishes. But already, there are some jaw-dropping moments in it and things that make you go, oh my God, you know. And as someone that didn't have to hide his sexuality for very long, it's a good way to remind myself of how lucky I am, and that younger LGBT people, we do stand on the shoulders of the people that came before us, and it's a good reminder of that, I suppose.
But interestingly, also doing that and writing the books as well has also been part of my coming out and my coming to terms with, because I think that's I shouldn't need to come to terms with being gay, but recognizing my sexuality and being comfortable with it and being comfortable in my skin and being comfortable talking about it. So writing the books and certainly doing that podcast, that Rainbow Dads podcast, is all about me coming out. And I've listened to a couple of them since, you know, with a bit of distance of time. You know, there's things that I talk about in those podcasts for the first time, you know, I reveal for the first time. And you can sense that in people's voices, you know, that this is real. They're talking about this for real, you know. So it's not set up. We certainly didn't have any knowledge of the questions beforehand. So, so I would recommend anyone to go and have a listen, definitely.
Yeah. And I will second that.
But also, also interestingly, wives of gay men as well, you know, who are living in that situation that perhaps they can't understand or get to grips with, and children as well, you know, older children who have parents who have come out later in life to listen to. They might gain something from it, I think.
Yeah, I think that's the benefit of it. It is, like, as I said, I've only listened to so much, but already people open up an awful lot really early in about things that happened to them and experiences they had that, you know, had such an impact on them for the rest of their life. And I think it does. Yeah. I think that's the most important thing about sharing stories like this. And that's kind of one part of my aspiration with this podcast is to get to hear people's stories and that kind of thing, you know. So what I'd like to know now is, we'd like to maybe look at the future and what's, you know, your to be continued. So this is always like I structure it beginning, middle, end, but I don't like saying end because that's very ominous. So we'll say your to be continued. So when this interview is over, this is a very easy question. What's the first thing you're going to do when we said our good looks and our goodbyes and I'm up with you planning on doing today?
Well, I'm working on my next book. So, which is, because I've realized the importance of people telling their stories, and I've been in self-publishing now for a number of years. I ran a group of self-published independent authors set up a group, which is still going quite successfully. Not LGBT, but, you know, anyone who was self-publishing. So I thought, well, I need to write a book to tell people how to do that, how to self-publish. Not about creative writing, but how to, you know, the processes of you need to go through to make a book and to self-publish it. But also importantly, from an LGBT point of view, because I wanted to encourage people who are LGBTQ plus to feel that they can tell their stories. And I think by writing a book, it can be so cathartic and healthy and improve your well-being, but it also helps other people who will pick up that story, because you may think that your story is unique to you and of no interest to anyone else. But everybody's story is fascinating, you know, where they came from and how their lives pan out and the events and things that happen to them, where they end up. So I think it's really vitally important that people tell their stories. So I've written the sort of how-to part of the book, if you like, but I'm interspersing that with stories from LGBT people who have published their own book.
Oh, okay, cool.
So I'm asking them, you know, what drew you to publish your book, and how did that happen, and what has the effect been like since, and what do you hope to gain from it? So yeah, so really, again, really interesting story. So I've got a couple of those to go through today. So that's what I'm going to be doing after we've finished. Yeah,
very busy.
Yeah, but also I've got later on today a Zoom call with Queer Britain.
Oh yes, and that's I hadn't forgotten. Don't worry. So Queer Britain is it's a museum that you're kind of working towards. It's not a brick and mortar museum yet, I believe, but that's the goal.
But that is the goal. Yes. So I'm part of the social media team. I volunteer for them. And again, it's something that I'm hyper passionate about. It's the interest started for me with the V&A in London. They run. Back before, you know, COVID, they ran before and after. They ran monthly LGBTQ tours. So you would get taken around by a guide, a museum guide, a professional guide, who would show you artifacts and talk to you about the artists and the artifact, specifically the queer story behind them. And I've always been interested in history. So this was just like amazing for me. A guy called Joe Galliano came up with the idea of an actual bricks and mortar LGBTQ museum, where different artifacts from different museums that are set out in different cabinets and in different galleries all over the place can be brought together so that we can tell our story and have our culture recognized and talked about, because the gay culture
and importantly preserved,
yes. And where you will have, you know, school kids on school parties and go, you know, as they do, they go to the British Museum or the V&A and they look, or the National Portrait Gallery, and I'm sure they do in Dublin as well, go to various you know, museums and get shown things. Well, now they can be shown a specific LGBTQ history and see the importance of it throughout history, and instead of it being hidden and not talked about and not passed on from one generation to another, having a museum will definitely do that. Will say this is your history, and it is just so important. And it just I'm passionate about it, and I hope to goodness that I do see that day come. You know.
Yeah, and that, I think
walk that, through the doors.
Yeah, hopefully you'll get to at least see the foundations, and then eventually you're laying the foundations now, I suppose. You know, and especially with books like yours, I think that just proves that there is a need for that kind of thing, and not just in the island of Britain, but the island of Ireland and every country around the world. Like the thing about LGBT kind of culture and communities is that they were often very isolated to their own city or wherever. So sometimes completely different cultures emerged and different codes or languages even. So it is very important to preserve all them, even just from a historical point of view.
I think it's important that we talk about it, to us, not to the wider society necessarily. And certainly, in Western cultures where, LGBT laws are more equal. And so we do have a better life, but we need to start talking to ourselves and recognizing our history and talking about it and proclaiming it, if you like, championing it.
I'm not going to try and copy that word, but I agree with the sentiment. So when do you have any plans for when your next book will be coming out? Do you have a release month, even if not a date?
Not specifically, which again is one of the good things about being an independent writer. Mm. You can choose when you launch. I'm not very good at putting dates on things because invariably that changes, doesn't it?
It'll be done when it's done.
It'll be done when it's done. And, it'll be ready when it's ready. But hopefully, certainly next year, 2021, certainly, definitely.
Good, great. Just two quick questions there, just for the, and then we'll be wrapped up. Where can people find you and Rainbow Dads and Queer Britain Museum all online? Like, how can they get to that?
So I'm on Twitter at David Ledane, also on Facebook, but Facebook's not, it's a funny place. Funny place, Facebook. It's good for groups, but that's about it. Mainly on Twitter at David Ledane, at Rainbow Dads on Twitter and Instagram, at queer_Britain is across social media as well. But do get in touch.
Brilliant. My final question, it's the same question I ask every guest and every season, I suppose, is what was the last book you read?
The last book I read, I actually wrote this down because I knew I'd forget it because it was one of the questions you sent me. Now, let's have a look. Oh, yes. So the last book I read was a book called Divine Sage by J.P. Cunningham. And it's a high seas adventure set in the 1820s based on a true story, but with a gay twist. It's about they sail off to Latin America and have an adventure in the Aztec culture or whatever. I don't know, you won't remember this, but back in the day there was a program called the Oneidan Line, and it was set on the tall ships that used to come in and out of Liverpool, and schooners, and they'd sail across the world. And I loved that program when I was a kid. So the Captain Hall in this book is my gay James Oneidan. So that was the last book I read.
Very good. David, it's been great to have you on, and it's great to hear your story, but also give you another chance to tell your story because it's a really important one. And thank you very much for being on the show.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Really good.
Brilliant.
I have to say thank you so much to David for agreeing to be on the show, and more importantly for giving such an honest and wonderful interview. As you heard in the interview, David Ledane is his pen name, and I didn't ask this in the recording, but I did ask him afterwards, and the origin of his pen name is great. Ledane is David's birth mother's surname, and David comes from, it should be obvious, it comes from David Bowie, doesn't it? Since we've been talking, David has been working hard on his latest project, a new book about helping LGBT+ people publish their own stories, just like David did. It is called Tell Your LGBTQ+ Story. Be sure to check out David on Twitter or Facebook in the links in the show notes below. Finally, if you enjoyed the show, tell a friend about it. Just give it a mention or a tweet or whatever you can. Sharing a podcast like this is the main way it can grow, so that all these amazing stories can be shared all around the world. And if you loved the show, check out the Patreon page. Be sure to check out next week's episode, where I interview Dougie Brimson. Dougie has many, many novels out there, and some non-fiction books as well, starting with his first one, Everywhere We Go, from 1996, based on the Euros League at the time. And he also is the screenwriter for Green Street, a film that's starring Charlie Hunnam and Elijah Wood. So that was, it was a really, really good interview, and very different from the ones I've done so far, as I'm sure you'll hear next week. That's it for me for this week. See you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you loved listening to this episode just as much as I loved recording it. If you like the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or over on Podchaser. Until then, be good, be brave, and tell stories. See ya.